I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. College athletics is big business, with football and men's basketball generating billions of dollars a year. TV and marketing deals are lucrative moneymakers for sports-centric colleges and universities. Many top coaches have generous multi-million dollar salaries. Joe Nocera, writing in the New York Times Magazine, complained that the labor force, the players, get nothing from these profits. Quote, "The workers are supposed to be content with a scholarship that does not even cover the full cost of attending college," unquote. Nocera is the most recent critic of the NCAA and college sports, calling them exploitive and hypocritical. This has revived the question, should college athletes be paid if their university is profiting off their performance? Our subject for today's Radio Times, and we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Stephen Danley played basketball for the University of Pennsylvania, where he was co-captain, led the team to three Ivy League championships. He's currently a Marshall Scholar in the final year of a doctorate at Oxford University. And Stephen Danley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me,
Marty. You're very welcome. Kenneth Shropshire is a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, also faculty director of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative, author of a number of books, including most recently Negotiate Like the Pros, A Top Sports Negotiator's Lessons for Making Deals, Building Relationships, and Getting What You Want. And Ken Shropshire, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
And Ken, if I could begin with you, is this an issue that comes and goes but never gets resolved?
It may be the oldest sports story in America. It started certainly back in the 1800s with should we pay the champion between a rowing competition with Yale and Harvard. So it's not a new topic, but it's certainly one that's taken on a new level of interest by folks.
But do you think it's an unresolvable topic? And we'll get into some of the details, but as you look at it, and you've looked at it for some time now,
I think philosophically people can decide that it's okay or not. I think mechanically it's a very difficult situation to work out. If you do decide that in some way providing greater compensation to student athletes is something you want to do, my mind explodes trying to figure out how to actually make it happen and maintain a level of fairness.
And I do want to pick up on that. Let me get you in on the conversation here, Stephen. And you played for the University of Pennsylvania. I'm assuming the Ivies are in a slightly different category when we talk about this issue.
Yeah, in a couple of different ways. I didn't get a scholarship to go play. I turned down scholarships at a number of other minor schools. You used the phrase led Penn to an Ivy League championship. I wasn't a great basketball player. I'm not sure people were lining up to pay me to come into schools, but played with some great teammates. And so I think I have some interesting things to say about the whole process.
But do you think college athletes should be paid?
I mean, I think they already are paid in some ways. You know, scholarships are worth a lot of money, and schools have found ways to get players money in ways that are legal. You know, there's housing stipends. There's a Sports Illustrated article that just came out that suggested paying players $1,000 a month. Well, that's about what they get to cover housing and living expenses now on a full scholarship. And so there's some ways to tweak some of those numbers if what you're really concerned about is just sort of a quality of life and making sure these players have enough to live on and getting the basics. It's obviously not what the top players are worth in the top programs, and so that's a different issue about what these players are worth to the universities.
In some of the reading I did, and I think it was a program on PBS, that the average scholarship comes up short, about $3,000 or $3,500 short, so that athletes, yes, they might get a scholarship, but it doesn't cover the cost of going to a university or college.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious. I didn't have a scholarship, so I'm not super familiar. And there's restrictions. You can't have a job while you're on scholarship and on campus, and some different things like that. That said, I think it's a pretty good deal in a lot of ways, right? You're getting an education. It's an advantage in terms of getting into the school. Those things can be very good for athletes. And also, it's not a bad lifestyle. You know, to play for a high-profile team, you're sort of a leader among your peers. It's a lot of opportunities after school. I think you can live on it. I think the NCAA can probably do a better job of making sure students are in a good situation while they're in school.
I'd be curious what you say to that, Ken. And we're talking about student athletes here. The NCAA says they're students first, athletes second.
Well, you know, I'm thinking back. I actually had a scholarship as well at Stanford University in the early 70s. And four-year scholarship, and I didn't play at all, but I got paid for 4 years. It was the greatest situation in the world.
This was a sports scholarship?
This was a football scholarship,
Football.
Now, if I had been one of the stars of the team and if I had a family that needed some money, and you know, I may have felt differently about it. I look back at it on one of the most positive experiences I could have had. So the point that I try to get people to get to is there's nothing wrong with providing greater compensation to these athletes. It's just very difficult to make it happen. It's very difficult to figure out how much. I mean, how much is a difficult issue, too. Filling that gap that you talk about, the cost of attendance, seems like a no-brainer. I mean, why not? If the dollars are there, why not do that? What's the problem with doing that? But once you get beyond that number, it gets difficult economically to figure out, are there other priorities that an institution of higher learning should be focused on rather than channeling more dollars to student-athletes?
What kind of dollars are we talking about? I had read some numbers, you know, $6 billion a year when you add everything up. Obviously, some colleges, universities, and I guess sports departments are making a lot of money, but that's probably not true for everybody, Ken.
Well, it's not true for most. I mean,
but
you can think about it too. If you're paying a football coach, and we'll see some coaches playing in the coaching in the championship football game for BCS, and making $4, $5, $6 million a year. I mean, certainly you could take some of those dollars, shave them off, and give them to the players that are playing in those games. Is that a better use of those dollars? Does that make more sense? Should labor receive more than management? I mean, it's kind of the classic kind of story. So it's not something that there's any reason not to do. I mean, the old story is amateurism. The old story are the myths of ancient Greeks dancing around with fig leaves and participating in sport for the glory of sport. It turns out that's all mythical. It didn't happen. It's more based on a British model of the kind of separation of classes and building from there. So there's no foundation that says there should not be greater compensation going to student athletes.
And to you, Stephen, I guess what rankles some is just when you look at some of these colleges and universities that are paying coaches, you know, millions of dollars, making lots of money off some of these sports, and particularly some of these athletes, whether they deserve a little piece of that pot.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible feeling as an athlete to walk into a stadium in which everyone is paid and you're not getting paid and you're not getting a piece of it. And it goes with your coaches as well. I had a number of coaches sit me down while I was playing at Penn and said, "Steve, you got to start playing better." And I said, "You know, I'd love to play better." And they turned around and they said, "Well, I have a family to feed, and if we don't win a championship this year, I'm probably not going to be around next year." It happened to me with two different coaches. I think it's a pretty common thing. It's a weird thing for you to be told you're an amateur and other people to come up to you and tell their job depends on you, and you don't necessarily see the fruits of that in the way they do. I think the power dynamic among coaches and with the NCAA is very, very strange, and players are smart. They're aware of that. They can see that when they walk in the gym or they walk in the bookstore and, you know, their jersey's hanging on the wall.
But that was really an impossible thing. I mean, I'm assuming you were playing at the top of your game. You were playing as good as you could play.
Right.
I mean, but it wasn't good enough for the coach?
Coaching effort is always an interesting thing. But athletes are in a position that in some ways is not very powerful, right? Once you make the decision to sign somewhere, if you want to transfer, you have to give up a year to go somewhere else, whereas coaches can change positions without sort of those things. You're in a position where if you're in a scholarship, the coach can take away that scholarship at the end of the year. That happens to players. So coaches get away with doing stuff that you could never imagine happening. You know, your boss isn't going to walk in here and just curse you out for 2 hours a day. That happens pretty common on the basketball court. And, you know, it's part of the sports culture, but it's also partially because athletes aren't that empowered in the college basketball system. And that's what I can speak to.
Can you speak to that, Ken?
Oh no!
The power differential here that we're talking about?
It is amazing. I'm sitting here as a 56-year-old man still thinking about some of the things that coaches said to me about how bad I was and what I needed to do. And so it is pretty interesting. And it does. If the money is on that side, then that makes that position even more powerful. Again, not to say it's wrong, not to say that any of these coaches are overpaid. I mean, you get what you can in the marketplace, but that's not what student-athletes are allowed to do. There's certainly some measure of increased revenue that should go in that direction.
But can we say, I mean, and you both played, you didn't get a scholarship, you did, Ken. You got to go to college. I mean, you got to go to a good university, and that was part of being an athlete, even if you weren't good enough on the field. Right.
Oh, no, it was one of the greatest periods in life to go to school for free. And it's a wonderful opportunity. It's not one that should be shrugged at, and there's nothing wrong if it stays that way. But I think what we can't do is stop short of providing greater revenues to athletes just because. I mean, there's no real reason not to, in my mind, other than the economics and actually the logistics of making it happen.
You want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty hesitant to praise the NCAA as an organization. I think it's more dictatorship than sort of democracy, and there are some real power problems there as well. That said, some of the reforms they've looked at, and they're sort of in between. They passed an additional stipend of $2,000, and it looks like that may not go. It's still in the process of happening. But some of those smaller things, just the process of allowing schools to offer a full four-year scholarship rather than 1 year at a time.
And that's how it is now, 1 year at a time?
1 year at a time, right, for athletes. And if you could offer 4 years, that means I could choose to go to a place that, one, is promising me my education rather than, you know, if I get hurt or if different things happen, maybe getting thrown out the door. So can you empower athletes? Can you give them a little better support in terms of healthcare? I like all those sort of medium-term things that we can do while we have a bigger debate about, you know, what's going on with all this money. And it's big business. So chalk that up. I think the NCAA, among a bunch of things that they're getting wrong, are sort of getting a couple things right.
Well, and even picking up on that, Ken, the idea of doing more to help these student athletes get through college and get an education and get that particular degree that they're looking for. Is there enough done to help the student athlete?
Well, there needs to be more. There was a great kind of groundbreaking study in 1929. The Carnegie Foundation funded this study. And one of the things that came out of it was that essentially student athletes, such as they were then, were graduating about the same rate as regular students. And then the similar study on into the 50s, it was about the same. But it gets to the 60s and 70s when we start to see the fall off, when we start to see something different happening and the graduation rate of student athletes falling below that of the typical student. So and the idea of finishing is something that's important. The idea of putting more focus, the idea of keeping the student part and the student-athlete piece, that's a big piece that the NCAA could play a greater role in the member institutions. That's something that, you know, all this money and all these other issues are important, but if you get this scholarship, you get this opportunity to go to college, well, why not get the full benefit? Why not get out of there with a degree?
And we're almost up in a break here, but is it that they are recruiting a different kind of student-athlete, or they're not doing enough to help that student-athlete make it through the university or college?
Well, probably a little bit of both. I mean, and probably a little bit sport by sport. Certainly with basketball, there's a lot more of the one and done, or I'm going for a couple of years. This is the way I can be on stage and be seen. With football, a little bit different. You've got to stay in school longer, so there's a greater opportunity to be indoctrinated and say, okay, this degree thing is not a bad idea. And then you've got the Ivy model, which in some ways is this great opportunity, a great unique situation where typically you have to be a great student to get through the process.
Well, let's take that break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Kenneth Shropshire. He's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, also faculty director of the Wharton Business Sports Initiative. Also with us is Stephen Danley. He played basketball at the University of Pennsylvania, co-captain of a team that won 3 Ivy League championships. I think you feel better with me saying it that way. He's also a Marshall Scholar. In fact, finishing his final year of a doctorate at Oxford University. And today on Radio Times, we're taking a look at student athletes and raising the question whether they should be paid, especially if they are playing for colleges and universities making lots of money off of sports. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra's January Beethoven celebration continues as Arabella Steinbacher performs Beethoven's Violin Concerto. Arabella Steinbacher joins conductor Robin Ticciotti for Beethoven's Violin Concerto. Tickets at philorc.org and at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, the January Beethoven celebration continues with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Iowans take pride in their caucuses, but voters in New Hampshire will remind you that their primary is the first in the nation. Now the battle for the Republican nomination comes to the Granite State, and NPR News is there. I'm Mara Liasson. Join us for results, reaction, and analysis when the votes are tallied tomorrow. Live coverage of the New Hampshire primary from NPR News.
Coverage begins tomorrow night at 8 on WHYY.
If your New Year's resolution includes more new music, this is the show for you. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. And this week on Sound Opinions, we review new records by The Roots, Amy Winehouse, and the Black Keys. Before you spend your hard-earned dough, tune in to see if these albums get a buy it, a burn it, or a trash it.
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Kenneth Shropshire and Stephen Danley, and we are talking about athletes who are playing for colleges and universities, the student-athlete conundrum, and whether they should be paid for their performance on the field or on the court. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think? Ken, let me go back to you and pick up on something you talked about earlier, which is that while it might not be a bad idea to pay these student athletes, the actual institution of how you're going to do that's really where the problem is. What are the problems you see in implementing a program like this?
Well, two problems, one much bigger than the other. The first is the terrible mistake a scholar athlete like myself that do you really want to pay somebody who's not contributing much to the team? Or how do you pay them compared to a John Elway or a star player on a team? So some of the proposals have some minimums there, and then you kind of negotiate up from that point. But that's very difficult to figure out how to do. The second and most important, and one of the greatest changes in athletics in America in the past quarter century has been Title IX and the idea of providing gender equity in sports and providing equal opportunities for women to participate in sport. Many of the proposals that are out there ignore the need to continue to push on that effort and the need for equal distribution of revenues to men and women in collegiate sports. So they often think about paying men's basketball and football, but what about on the women's side? And how do you keep it equal there? So that's the mechanical piece that's very difficult, and it's too important an issue to ignore.
Stephen, what about the idea, and this is something that Joe Nocera said in the New York Times magazine article, which is lifetime insurance for student athletes. Does that make sense to you?
I think there's some great sort of mid-level common sense reforms, right? Guaranteeing your scholarships, offering a fifth year to make sure students have an opportunity. You know, a lot of big-time basketball programs, the coaches actually won't let you take enough classes to graduate in 4 years, and so you have to come back over the summers because they need you there for practice. They don't want you overloaded during the season. So just giving some players some extra protections. That said, the elephant in the room in this discussion is that big-time basketball players and big-time football players are worth an amazing amount of money to the university. And it's that elite. You know, I wasn't worth a whole lot to Penn, maybe a little bit. But if you go and look at a place like a North Carolina or a Duke, those players are worth a lot of money. And they tend to end up getting it one way or another. And I think that's a sort of an interesting issue. I know it more. These things, they aren't talked about in the open, but there's these urban legends, and the way it works is that a top basketball recruit, Kevin Durant, a guy who's one and done, the price tag on a guy like that is rumored to be about $300,000. And that's going to come to him one way or another through boosters, through different things. So we can say all we like, it's difficult for the NCAA to do this. But there's markets at play, and these players are worth a lot.
Are you saying that while he's playing, he's make that kind of money, or he's sort of building equity as he moves through college or university and looks at graduation?
And this is one of the reasons I'm so critical of the NCAA is, you know, we can talk about players getting free tattoos or different things, but there are players out there who I've you hear stories, these are urban legends as much as anything else, but are getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars from boosters and from agents while they're playing. And it's obviously a violation, but if you're worth $1 million to the university, there are people who are going to be out there who are going to bend the rules to do that. So that's the other side of this argument, they're going to get paid one way or another, and can we make that a process that's sort of less corrupt and basically keeps more good guys in the fold?
What do you think about that, Ken? I mean, there's something about the system that ends up corrupting itself.
Yeah, and the first time I looked at it very closely was with regard to sports agents, the book I wrote was called Agents of Opportunity, and a lot of what it looked at was this opportunity that Stephen's talking about that somebody's going to fill that gap, and typically it's boosters, typically it's sports agents who see the value, either for the school or for the sports agent. It's money that I can make if I represent this guy or woman later on. And it's very difficult, no matter how much the NCAA would contemplate providing in terms of revenue to athletes, to get to the real numbers. We looked at, I was on a committee once that looked at maybe giving $30,000, $35,000 additional money to top-level basketball players, carving out basketball in some way. And the thought was, well, that's not enough. I mean, somebody's going to come in and provide more. That's not the number. And if you start thinking about what the real numbers are, it gets very difficult again. And that's another one of the mechanical problems of how to make this actually be practical.
Because if someone is literally worth $300,000, are you going to pay them as a student athlete $300,000?
And there's the problem. And that gets to the point where can your budget really withstand that? Maybe you shift priorities. Maybe you take some of that money away from coaches, and maybe you eliminate some other sports that are not revenue generating. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's very difficult.
So I do want to go ahead, Stephen.
I just want to be real clear. I'm not for paying an athlete $300,000, but I think this is the part of the discussion that, as a student athlete and as someone who went to a university, I rankle at a little bit. If they want to pay $300,000, that's because that's what the university is making off of you. And so that's a weird thing to say, well, should the university be paying that, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're having people come to games, you have your TV contracts, there's a lot of demand. And so is there an equity issue almost the other direction? And this is where you get philosophical. I don't know that there's something you can do about this, but if a university is earning $1 million off an athlete, $200,000, $300,000 off an athlete, you know, is it fair not to address that?
But what about, and I'm just throwing this out here, some kind of a trust fund some way of investing in someone who's making this return without paying them $300,000?
Well, Olympic sports became more professionalized, that was the first step they took. The track and field athletes, the first thing that went in place was something called a TAC trust, where monies could go to the athletes, but in trust, and they could only pull out living expenses. But once they stopped participating, they could get all the money. So there are little tricks you can do in between that are possible. I mean, again, very difficult to administer. I mean, think about a whole school with everybody having their own trust. I mean, it could be very difficult.
The other one players do that's pretty common is if you're going to stay at a university level and you're worried about getting injured, but you have future earnings, is you can take out loans against your future earnings. And there's sort of insurance. I don't think you can formally take out a loan, but you can take insurance so that pays out and you guarantee yourself at least a little of that future earnings, so there's less risk involved. So I think these are examples of things that are a little more formal and sort of would be nice. And the problem is, as less of those things are done, you get the informal things. And that's a pretty shady market. You know, I'm not super skeptical of the AAU world in basketball, but there's a world where it's people from the neighborhoods and the cities and the sports agents who are really involved, and some of them really care about the athletes and are doing great work, and some of them are leeches and attach themselves to athletes to get a piece of that money.
Ken, I'm wondering also about the likeness of players. We were talking before the show began with some of the people working on the show about video games, where you've now got college athletes and they're part of a video game. Someone is making money off of their likeness, their number, their name.
And that's where some of the major lawsuits are winding their way through the courts based on that there are likenesses and images, and that in some ways the NCAA argues the students have signed away those rights, and we had the right to do this, to use these images and to sell them off. So so that's being resolved now. That some of the issues were battled to a level conclusion at the professional level, where it's something the courts have basically said, no, you can't do that. You've got to pay people for using their likeness and their images.
Once they turn pro, once they're a professional athlete, right?
Well, the argument that we're looking at, the case we're seeing, the O'Bannon case, is one where the idea of what about these collegiate athletes do?
Whether they own their own image,
whether
likeness?
You own your own likeness, or have you signed it away when you sign these letters of intent and these annual letters you have to sign, almost a contract of adhesion. You almost have to. If you want to get your scholarship, you got to sign this document. So this is not really a choice to do so. So that's part of what the discussion is about.
Go ahead, Stephen, then we'll get to our callers.
I was just going to say the power dynamics with the NCAA are really weird, and the feeling that you have to sign away your rights to play and different things. They sat us down about drug testing, and it's not a huge deal in the team where I was. But to drug test, you basically can be called back to campus at any time. You're home for spring break. You're home for the summer. You can be called back, and you have to be there within a certain amount of money. You have to pay for your own way. And sitting in that room and knowing, if I want to play college basketball, I just have to sign this stuff, even though it seems very unfair. And that's not to say that there shouldn't be drug testing or reasonable things. But, you know, if you're taking a vacation over spring break and you have the opportunity, it probably means you didn't make the tournament in my case, which is a bad thing. But if you're in Florida, the thought that the NCAA can call up, make me come back to campus, I have to pay for that. And there's nothing I can do about that. It made me very uneasy as a player. And so I think it gets to some of these bigger issues where part of this is about money and part of it's about the fact that the players don't have the power in the system.
Yeah. And that's Stephen Danley joining us with Kenneth Shropshire. We are talking about student athletes, whether they should be paid, and if they're paid, how would that work? And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mary from Havertown called us up right away. Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, guys. There. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm nervous.
Don't be nervous.
I can't speak to the academics and the graduation rates and all that, but I can speak to the fairness about it. And if these schools are making so much money from a specific sport, it seems to me, and you touched on both these issues, but it seems to me that the players should be getting a lump sum every year in an IRA, something like that. That wouldn't be like a trust fund, that's not hard to administer. And then also medical insurance. You touched on that as well. I mean, this keeps them amateurs, but it seems to take care of any long-term problems that they may occur. I mean, look at head injuries and things like that. And it just seems fair.
Well, Mary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Ken, she's saying, you know, it's not so hard to solve this problem from her perspective. Agreed.
Well, the difficulty comes that you put that proposal out there. The NCAA, but one thing people need to step back and think about is that the NCAA is made up of 1,000-plus member institutions. So, and it's run, I mean, if you think Congress is difficult to deal with, think about these different institutions with their different interests and rights and constituencies. So you put that proposal before the NCAA in the various formats they allow. If it got on the floor, it would take years for something like that to pass. But it's not something that's not viable in terms of here's an answer. Look sport by sport and see what the bottom line is on those and think about a distribution there. I mean, it's certainly a practical way to think about it.
One of the quotes from the NCAA is student athletes are students first, athletes second. They are not university employees who are paid for their labor. I mean, that has been a response, Stephen, from the NCAA.
Right, and I understand both sides of this. I certainly was a student first. That said, my basketball commitments had to be the first priority for my schedule, and that's what you built your schedule around, your class schedule around. It's a serious, serious commitment, and one the university makes money of. I think part of the problem here, and maybe it's even too big picture to talk about, but the economics of higher education are very, very strange. And so, you know, sort of as a process of evolution, you have a situation where a couple of revenue sports help to subsidize a lot of other sports, and universities as a whole don't make a lot of money sort of in small term off these sports. There's only a couple of athletic programs that are really pulling in a lot of extra money. You know, the Sports Illustrated article, which had a number of interesting proposals, talked about, you know, women's rowing there lost $1 million a year. Well, that money has to come from somewhere. So if you look at a single sport in isolation, I think this fairness case is an interesting one. But the problem is the system's very, very complex, and you're using that money to subsidize other things. Is that fair? Is it fair in a gender way due to Title IX? Maybe. Is it fair in terms of the specific athletes in the revenue programs? Doesn't feel very fair. I mean, it's very, very difficult from an economics perspective. That said, in the long term, there are a lot of people making their livings basically off of essentially free labor, although I don't want to minimize, you know, a scholarship
sure.
is still worth a lot of money to a lot of these schools. But it's certainly the case that over the long term, the economics could be different. But in the short term, it's very hard. Even the NCAA, they approved, it was what, a $2,000 stipend
right.
for athletes. And then athletic departments came back and said, we can't afford it. So it's not just like there's magical money out there to be used in the short term.
Let me get Mary. Thanks for the call. Let's see what Nelson from Delaware has to say. And Nelson, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I was actually my question involved the actual viability of the students who are actually being accepted into these programs. I think that it's pretty well known that there are larger Division I schools that are accepting people who aren't actually capable of attending the college or graduating from the college in order to bolster their on-field performance. And I wonder about the integrity of that entire system. That's sort of where I'm coming from.
Well, no, it's a good question. I'm tossing it to you, Ken Shropshire.
Well, I mean, you've hit the big issue over the years, too. That so one side has always been compensation. The other side has been academic reform and the idea of focusing on the academic success of a potential success for student athletes. And this really started to be looked at seriously in the 70s. There was a rule that someone was old enough to remember called the 1.6 rule. You had to project to get at least a 1.6 GPA to play collegiate sports. So this is an issue that's it's increased in terms of how what your predicted success level has to be. So the NCAA has focused on this more and more, but it is still more of a home rule kind of situation. It is a school-by-school kind of determination. Again, I mean, we're fortunate enough to be in an atmosphere where the Ivies, again, are at a much higher level in terms of where you have to perform and where you have to have performed before you come in. But it's an issue that's important. Home rule controls to a large extent, so that may be where you're reflecting on some of the lower level performance.
I mean, I've even seen references to a plantation system. I don't know if you ascribe to that or you see plantation system.
Yeah, so that one irritated me. Taylor Branch in the Atlantic article used that phrasing. And what's interesting about them, he also used the phrase colonial too, that which may be a little bit more appropriate in terms of the paternalistic kind of view that the NCAA takes on about what's not good for you to do this, it's not good for you to do that. But the idea, anytime somebody kind of raises the issue of more the plantation slave kind of, I mean, there's so many issues associated with that. I think that one's inappropriate.
What do you think, Stan?
My immediate response is, I rankle a little bit when people say, oh, these people don't deserve to be in schools. And that's not to say that there aren't people getting in on athletic scholarships who their academic credentials don't necessarily meet some of the average numbers of the rest of the university. But first of all, they're bringing something to the school, and I think it does bring a lot to have athletes on campus. I think there's definitely out of school, there's people that specifically recruit athletes because of their work ethic, because of different things. And, you know, I saw a lot of people make bad decisions as 18 and 19-year-olds in the dorms in a lot of different ways. And in some ways, athletes bring a lot to the campus. They're people that they have a safety net where they can't be making some of those bad decisions. If you don't go to class as a regular student, you know, the worst thing that happens is you deal with your parents. You deal with, you know, maybe you deal with the administration if you're failing out of school. You know, you have a coach on your, you know, on you all the time if you're an athlete. In some ways, it brings something really dynamic to the university. And these are people that in some situations put in a lot of work. And I think it's a little hypocritical to say maybe they don't deserve to be there when there's a lot of people that, you know, they're going to school and making their own decisions. So,
well, and we're almost up in another break here. But, Stephen, I also think it taps in, at least for some colleges and universities, this obsession with sports, particularly football, and in many cases basketball as well, and keeping alumni happy and keeping the money rolling in.
Right. I mean, sure, that's the economics of it, right? The donations come in after big wins. I'm really familiar with the George Mason case or the St. Joe's case, but applications shoot up 4 or 5 times after they make a run in the NCAA tournament. Mm-hmm. Those things are great for the school, and those are things athletes can help bring to the table. And as long as you're giving them sort of the appropriate support so that they have a chance to do well in the academic university, I think that's great, and you want to have those type of people involved in the program, and athletics can be a really positive thing.
And we are taking a very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation with Stephen Danley and Kenneth Shropshire. We're talking about student athletes and raising the question about how they are treated, should they be paid. And we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the University of Pennsylvania's Clinical Doctorate in Social Work program. Are you a master's-level social worker? Have you ever thought of pursuing a doctorate and felt that your options were limited? The program enables social workers to earn a doctoral degree in just 3 years without career disruption. More information can be found online at sp2.upenn.edu/dsw or 215-898-5550.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Rin Tin Tin, a dog found in the wreckage of a kennel during World War I, who would become one of film, radio, and television's biggest stars. We'll talk with author Susan Orlean about her new book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. It's her first original book since her bestseller, The Orchid Thief. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Thank you. What do you want for your life? Many of us choose one path and want another, maybe one that's more creative, altruistic, or legacy-making. Making the switch can be scary and complex, but with careful planning and reflection, we gain clarity and confidence, and ultimately a new purpose. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, transitioning, opening up to what's next. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. So should big-time college athletes be compensated for their performance? And if they should be compensated, how would a system like that work? And we're talking with Kenneth Shropshire. He's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, faculty director of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative. Stephen Danley also with us. He played basketball at the University of Pennsylvania, part of a team that won three Ivy League championships. And now he's a Marshall Scholar. In fact, in his final year of a doctorate at Oxford University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, looking to the answer for that question. And we've got Andrew from Wilmington joining us on Radio Times. Andrew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
First, I'd like to say I played college football for a number of years. And I, fortunately enough, wasn't one of those that receive scholarship. And that's one thing I think that everybody seems to forget, is that not everybody's on scholarship. And, you know, considering you're in practice and doing something football usually from 2 o'clock to 10 o'clock every night, I mean, you really have no opportunities to have a work study or have an after-school job or anything like that. And that's why I feel that they should be paid, and not just so much the top-performing athletes, because you've also got a lot of the guys in your practice squad that are working just as hard, but still have no opportunity for any kind of income throughout the school year.
Well, Andrew, let me take your comments and give Stephen a chance to respond. And is he right? And he was describing working from 2 o'clock in the afternoon till 10 o'clock at night. Is that unusual?
No, I think that's very fair. I think that's pretty much what you'd plan as an athlete. And that's not to say you were working the whole time. You're showering. Maybe you're going to grab a bite to eat afterwards. You're lifting weights. Some of that's work you do on your own. Some of it's not. I'm going to pick on you a little bit here, Andrew, but actually I'm a little worried about this argument, because I'm just not sure once you start justifying it based on the hours people put in where it goes. You know, I went to Penn, and there's a million different people who are involved in a million different things for the organization that have a schedule that looks like that, that are leaving their house at 8 or 9 in the morning and getting back at 10 or 11 at night, doing a lot of work for the university that's not paid. I don't know how you'd afford paying everyone or paying you for those hours. And so it's an interesting question. I look at the walk-on thing, and maybe this is a little unfair, but it's evidence of that maybe it's a good deal. Why'd you choose to play? It's your dream. You got to fulfill that. You got to represent the university. Probably helped you out on campus. Are there ways we can make life a little bit easier for walk-on athletes or athletes who aren't high profile? Yes, but I'm not sure that paying them is a solution there.
Ken, your thoughts?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'm sure somebody that walked on and actually played wanted to get my scholarship. So in some ways, there is a little lack of fairness that can go on in that kind of setting. You know, the thing that the big piece that Taylor Branch ended up with in his piece in the Atlantic was that it should just be an open market. That we should just, I mean, we're Americans. Let's just open this up and see who wants to pay who what. And I think that there's something to that. I mean, something to that in a way to think about it, and that things would eventually settle out. So people in your situation, Andrew, maybe there would be some revenues that would come in your direction. But as it stands now, it's very difficult to get somebody on scholarship if they don't come in on scholarship, although it does happen.
But it would no longer be amateur sports, so would it? I mean, if you let the marketplace decide?
Yeah, but so what? I mean, what is amateur? You know, so the last amateurs on earth are college athletes in the United States. I mean, for the most part, that whole amateur label is really non-existent. I mean, either people are playing sport because they're playing for fun, love to get paid. I'd like somebody to pay me to play tennis. I mean, if I take the money, I guess I'm an amateur in that context. But so there's no real value to this amateur label, and whatever we would call it, college sports going forward, that would be fine.
I'm going to disagree a little bit here. I think that the amateurism is a myth. But it's a useful myth, and it's useful in the sense that the system is a little bit of a house of cards. We essentially, in basketball and football, have a minor league sports program under the auspices of college sports. And that has a lot of benefits. It means people are getting educations who might otherwise not get educations. There's a lot of people involved in universities who love it. It's a system we like, and I like. I'm a big college sports fan. It has very big downsides and things that aren't useful, and I think this gets back to the NCAA. But, you know, there are restrictions on practice times out of season, particularly for basketball. But it means that your coaches as a basketball player can't play with you, can't see you play out of season except for a particular number of hours. It puts you into the hands of people that maybe aren't going to help you as much. There's restrictions that there's almost this need to upkeep this sense of it's really amateur when it's really not. It's a full-time job. It's a year-round thing. And everyone who's involved in it knows that. So do you keep that myth going? I think you can sort of cut out some of those things. So that's where I'd go with the amateurism discussion.
Andrew, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like John from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. And John, go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have John? No? Let's try Andrew. And we have Andrew joining us from Easton, Pennsylvania. And Andrew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm sort of stuck on the NCAA's statement of students first, athletes second. Because I know they're talking about the athletes in the sports. But I guess my question is sort of as a college, which is first and foremost an institution of higher learning. I went to a state school in New Jersey and sort of watched as tuitions rose and professors were fired and other expenses grew. They were also using a lot of the money to build a new football stadium and to pay a coach millions of dollars and buy him a house and a helicopter. So my question is sort of where do you draw the line of, like, I know that a sport can generate a lot of revenue for a school, but where is, funding things such as like a helicopter for a coach, like, sure, where do you draw the line so much as the school making the money, the distributing that sort of money and that income and that revenue?
And Andrew, it's a good question. I'm back to you, Ken. Go ahead.
No, but priorities are important. Yeah. And a lot of the recent commentary talks about this arms race, this collegiate sports arms race. And what happens in arms races, people lose perspective. People spend too much trying to be overly defensive. So a lot of that is what we're seeing in this case. And you're right, perspective gets lost on what's the real purpose for this college or university? What are we supposed to be accomplishing? But then you get, as the president or as the head coach, it hits you. And, well, if we don't win, then we may lose some of this alumni interest. We may lose a TV deal. So that's where the balance has to come in.
But he's saying, does that require a helicopter? I know you can't specifically answer that, but it's like, where do you draw the line there?
Not everybody needs a helicopter. And I think that's going too far, probably.
Stephen, this is just looking at the Philadelphia Inquirer from yesterday, looking at Bill O'Brien's contract. He's the new coach at Penn State. According to the paper, his base salary is $950,000, radio and TV $1 million, Nike $350,000, and performance incentives estimated to be about $200,000. I didn't do the math here, but that's several million dollars there.
Absolutely.
At a university where there's a lot of scandal, not to say he's associated with that, but a scandal that raises a whole host of questions about college sports and the responsibility of coaches and all.
Yeah, big time sports are a messy thing. And I think there's no doubt about that. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of involvement. If you don't like it, then go to a D3 school. There's Williams. There's a lot of very quality schools that have chosen to make this other decision. And I think, one of the things that surprised me is how much it matters to alumni that I played basketball at Penn. And it's something that comes up over and over. They want the basketball program to do well. The reason these things are such big money is because there's such a demand for them and because people want to follow Penn State. They want Penn State to do well. And so I don't know that I have a problems with the numbers. Does it rub me a little bit the wrong way sometimes? Sure. But if someone wants to pay you that much money, I mean, good for it. I'd love for someone to pay me that much money,
Let me go back to this Joe Nocera piece, Ken, and just quoting here, the NCAA is going to take in something like $800 million a year, mostly from its March Madness TV contracts. We've been focusing a lot on sports departments and colleges and universities, but according at least to this article, the NCAA making $800 million a year on TV contracts.
Well, and those monies get distributed. I mean, so it's again, it's the member institutions that share in those dollars. And if I do nothing else positive today, it is to get people away from thinking about these folks in Indianapolis making a bunch of money, making a bunch of decisions. It is more of an amorphous body that's doing this. Although there's leadership opportunities. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mark Emmert, the director of the NCAA, I mean, by making statements, and they've done some wonderful things in terms of attacking Native American mascots or addressing different issues from the top and making leadership statements. So there's possibilities to do things, but it's very difficult to get that big body to move.
Let me get, looks like Professor R. something or other from Newark, and go ahead, you're on Radio Times. I just can't read all the names here on the computer. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I was just mentioning that in the United States, the universities are the only ones in the world that have athletic scholarships. The rest of the world has never heard of it. Mm. And we believe in studying rather than in playing football, baseball, or whatever it is. And I think as a professor, I would prefer to have a student concentrate on studies and not on getting money either from the university or from somebody else.
And when you say we, who's the we?
I beg your pardon?
You said, we want students to just focus on their studies.
European universities.
European universities.
Yes.
All right. Well, let me see what Stephen Daly has to say.
Yeah, so first of all, the statement's false. I played basketball at the University of Oxford, and we didn't have athletic scholarships, but I played against a number of schools that did offer them. In fact, I was just talking to a member of the team at the University of Pennsylvania trying to get him athletic scholarships so that he could go and pursue a master's degree. As an American, maybe it's just in my nature to say, well, there's a little exceptionalism going on. I don't know that just because we do it different than you, we do it wrong. I like the system. I think it supports the universities in a lot of ways. I saw Greg Easterbrook on ESPN a couple of weeks ago was making the case that we may be the only person with this model of high-performance athletics, but it's also the case that we have large, large donations and that these things may be linked. So maybe if you wanted your tenure position to be guaranteed, you could support the sports programs a little bit more.
Ken, you want to add anything to that?
No, it's just very different the way sport is treated around the globe. So instead of clubs and government support, here it happens through colleges and universities. And it does add a wonderful aspect 90% of the time to colleges and universities.
Let me see what Loria from Wilmington has to say. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I am a former student athlete, and I played at the D1 and the D2 level. At the D1, I do see where, you know, they should get compensated or we should get compensated for the, you know, amount of time that we put in. But at a D2 level, Division II, it's not your life. You actually do get that opportunity. I just want to make that clarification and see what their opinions were about that. And actually at the D3 level as well, that you don't get, you know, quote, scholarship money for the sport that you're playing. I just wanted to, you know, see their, you know, get the guys' opinions on what they think about that.
Lori, I have a quick question for you. What sport did you play?
Volleyball.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like you got a good education?
I did. I left after 2 years of playing down at Florida International, and then I played D2 at Goldie Beacom College here in Wilmington.
Well, let me see what Stephen Daly has to say.
I love D2 and D3 athletic programs. I think it's a really great model. I think it's a model that in some ways is much healthier for the student athlete. And I talk about physical health. I had back surgery my senior year. Mm. And that's obviously unfortunate. It's part of playing a high-profile sport. But when you're playing for higher stakes, there's more pressure on you. There's more pressure to get on the court. There's less control you have over those things. Playing at Oxford University, if my back was hurting, I got a chance to sit out for a day or two. And that was a decision I could make. And one of the things I think I'd like to see is reforms that allow Division I players to make more decisions like that. A system in which the trainers were really, really supporting the players, and players were encouraged to take more control over their bodies just from a health perspective. So I love the D2 programs.
Let me squeeze one more caller on. And it looks like we have Greg from Lancaster joining us on Radio Times. And Greg, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
My opinion, I went to a school that was Division II, and I supported the athletics. I was a tutor for football players and basketball players. And the thing that's being lost here is that you're going to school to go to school. You're going to a college to get an education. And even in the Division I schools where the sports and athletics are big money makers, the investment that the school is giving to these athletes, you know, one, they're going to a school with a big name, which makes them more valuable when they do go professional. Number two, they're getting an education, and if they're not getting an education, then they're not and they're not getting what they went there for in the first place. Well, as a tutor, there was times whenever I had to go to the coach and say, look, there's no way he's going to pass this class if you don't let him study.
Well, Greg,
because that's what I was paid to do. And
let me take your point only because the clock is telling me we're almost out of time, but can I be curious what you say back to Greg as a tutor of athletes?
Well, I think what you need to understand, it's a great opportunity to be in the academic setting when you don't realize it's something that's good for you. And so it's happened to so many kids over the years I've seen that they think they're going to make it to the NBA, they think they're going to make it to the NFL. The reality comes in to more kids than we realize. Freshman, sophomore year, this is not going to happen. And they find themselves in this wonderful setting like Penn or Stanford or Williams, wherever they may be, and they say, hey, I guess I have to figure out what's going to happen the rest of my life. So I think that the value of being in the college setting is very important, and that it doesn't always come out. It's not always that clear to kids that's what it's going to be, but it happens over and over again.
And do you think, we're almost out of time here, but tweaking around the edges, that some of what we've been talking about can be resolved, or at least some kind of solution to?
It's been a discussion since 1854, I think is the date.
I guess we won't take care of it in the year 2012. Well, thank you very much, Ken Shropshire, for joining us once again on Radio Times. And Stephen Danley, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. You. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us for the first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.